Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, October 14th. The union that represents drivers for the city's bus system flexes its political muscle at the start of a big week for the rail system. Could it derail the big reveal for segment two of Skyline? Talks between negotiators for the city and the Teamsters Union broke off yesterday. They are expected to resume later today, but the threat of a walkout may make riders nervous. We talk about housing goals and housing along the rail route. Honolulu Civil Beat takes a closer look at where we stand. And squeamish about lice, we hear about how a native shearwater deals with the parasite. And does everything on the internet stay around forever? We talk to a group trying to archive crucial moments through social media posts. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This is a big week for rail as Skyline's second segment to key employment centers will open to the public Thursday. But could labor talks with bus drivers derail a smooth start to the new phase of Skyline? Well, last night, the company that manages the bus put out a statement cautioning riders that its working contract expired in June and new terms have not yet been agreed upon with the Teamsters Union. There is a lot at stake. No one knows that better than Robert Yu, the head of Oahu Transit Services. He worked under Roger Morton, who previously held the post for 15 years. Morton is now city director for transportation services. Both men have sat on the board of HART, the agency which is building rail. Negotiators met yesterday, and after talks broke off last night, OTS issued a statement urging bus riders to consider alternative transportation if the Teamsters calls for a walkout. The city has asked for a week's notice, but OTS says the Teamsters feel that they don't have to give notice. Just within the last hour, we talked to Jenny Lamaoda, deputy director for Oahu Transit Services, to get the latest on negotiations.
Currently, we have under about 1,000 drivers.
And what is the base pay?
The base pay right now is $34.18.
And so, you know, we know that a lot is riding on the launch of this new service, but you folks have been working without a contract for some time?
That's correct. The contract ended on June 30th.
Why is it taking so long and that we're right up to this 11th hour that it's still not solved?
We continue to negotiate with them. We continue to both put our best foot forward, and sometimes it just takes a while.
What can you tell our listeners, because they may be a little bit concerned if they ride the bus, because we understand that there's some disagreement about whether Oahu Transit Services has to give notice about any kind of a walkout, if there is a walkout?
Sure. We put out the news release last night just out of an abundance of caution to allow customers to plan in case anything happens. So again, it is out of an abundance of caution. We carry 130,000 people on a daily basis. So we felt it was our responsibility as a precaution to get the word out that this could happen because so many people depend on the bus for their daily transportation to get to their job, school, and healthcare appointments and such. So we're just doing this out of an abundance of caution. We met yesterday, and we're planning to meet again today and tomorrow as well. We have planned meetings for today and tomorrow as well.
Okay. It's just that after talks broke off yesterday, you folks decided to issue the statement.
Again, yeah, it was just out of an abundance of caution. So despite what the union is saying, negotiations are still ongoing.
Well, some people might be a little worried because today we saw Kaiser members walk off the job. They're on strike for, I think, a week as they try and hammer out a labor contract.
We've asked for at least a 1 week's notice of a strike. However, the union claims it's not obligated to give us advance notice.
But this could really throw a monkey wrench into, you know, the plans to launch the second segment of rail.
Well, that's why we're doing everything out of an abundance of caution for everyone to plan accordingly.
Can you talk about the sticking points in the contract?
Sure. One thing I want to note is that we actually provide some very attractive benefits, such as OTS pays 100% of their active and retiree medical. We also pay 100% of their pension contributions, and that is not going to change. Of course, we do have, like any other negotiations, there's the sticking points are mainly the economic issues, such as wages and increased pension contributions.
Are the two sides very far apart? What's your sense?
Yes, we are. Unfortunately, yes, we are.
Was there not enough progress made since the contract expired in June?
Since I can just give you an update, when we left our internal meeting last night to discuss negotiations, we came back to the bus facility. We met internally and decided at that point that it was appropriate to offer mediation and reoffer a contract extension, including retro pay and health care.
And what was the response from the union?
We have not received a response yet. We're pending a response, and we're hoping at our meeting today we'll get a response.
That was Jenny Lamaota, Deputy Director for Oahu Transit Services. We spoke with her this morning about the ongoing labor dispute with the Teamsters, which represents drivers of the bus. We did also reach out to the Teamsters, but have not heard back. We will hear more about the plans for Skyline's second segment right after a short break. Of the next fresh air, we remember Diane Keaton and listen back to her 1997 interview. She talked about Annie Hall, The Godfather, singing, how she got her start in a production of Hair, and why she was one of the few performers in the cast who was not naked on stage. Keaton died Saturday at age 79. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Today on The Daily, the shutdown of the U.S. government has given the Trump administration an extraordinary amount of power to remake and, in some cases, to decimate dozens of agencies. It's a power that the administration learned how to wield when it systematically destroyed USAID. I'm Mike Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Welcome back to the conversation. A potential for a bus worker strike. And in the meantime, Honolulu City Council today takes up a proposed fare hike for the bus and other public transportation. So this is an interesting week indeed. In order to understand what the new Skyline extension looks like, we sat down with City Transportation Deputy Director John Noucci last week to talk about the new service to a major employment center, the military, and its thousands of civilian workforce at Pearl Harbor Hickam. Here's Noucci unpacking the Makalapa station service.
We accommodated our partners at the Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam with our first opening, but that meant we had a PH-8 bus that operated between the Halawa station, which is as far as we go currently, and took them into Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam. Now we get to actually take them from the station that is right outside the Makalapa gate. And that changes how we do things. So we will have two different routes that actually service Hickam, and we have one that services the Pearl Harbor Shipyard. And their ride gets tremendously shorter. They get off right at their station. They go right down the escalator and the stairs or the elevator to the bus stop right outside the station, and the bus just basically takes them there through Nimitz Gate and right into the heart of the shipyard.
And then a lot of the shipyard workers start early. So talk about how that's all being integrated.
Yeah, so we know how our city works. We come out of a city that operates very early. We are an early rising city. And I think part of it is also due to the fact that even if your job doesn't start early, a lot of people choose to leave early just to mitigate the congestion on the roadways. That's why we made that conscious decision to start Skyline at 4 a.m. So our service span compared to now, right now we operate on weekdays. We operate from 5 a.m. to 7 p.m. We're going to blow that wide open, and we're starting at 4 a.m. instead, making sure that all of our buses connect to these first trains, and we're operating all the way till 10:30 p.m. And that's by design. Our trains will operate every 10 minutes, so that same frequency that people have come to rely on, and that on-time performance that people have grown to rely on Skyline, They'll operate every 10 minutes until we get into the later hours, and then they'll go to 15-minute schedule.
So if people are needing to get to the airport to work, either with the airlines or with one of the vendors, they will have the option of making sure that they get there.
Yes, yes. And I think that value of being able to deliver people to their job centers and even from their job centers, there are people that work overnight at the airport and in that airport industrial area. There are good riders of our Route 40 right now, which runs 24 hours a day all the way between Ala Moana and Makaha. We know that those riders exist, and we wanted to extend our skyline hours as a nod to those people who use the bus right now at very early hours or very late hours.
I did talk to one rider who lives in Kalihi and works at the airport, and he has an overnight shift, and he expressed some concern that it was going to be tough for him just getting off at the stadium. But now that you have this route directly into the airport, it's going to help people like him.
Yeah, we have a group of, I call them the Skyline Aunties. There are a bunch of maybe over 10 aunties that work at USDA. And they've been meeting at our Keaunea UH West Oahu Station, carpooling and meeting there, taking Skyline to Halawa, and then riding our Route 20, current Route 20, into the stadium. Now, can you imagine that? They can just stay on Skyline now and go two more stations and get dropped off right at the USDA office where the station is. And I hear those stories and it really inspires me that we are doing things that will make huge differences in the lives of many people.
I did talk to one gentleman who was anxious for this line to open because he was looking to retire and wanted to go Vegas.
Yeah.
So he lived in Pearl City. And so for residents like that, having that airport access is also going to be tremendous.
And I think there's just little things that we know living on this island, right? So a lot of the airline schedules that we have, they're not necessarily built around our convenience. They're built around the continent's convenience, right? So you get on most flights leaving the continent at any time, and they'll get here generally in the afternoon and generally smack dab in the middle of our rush hour. And I just think about that. Like, our lives are structured around when we have congestion. And there's always that guilt of asking somebody, hey, can you pick me up at the airport at 3 or at 4? Because you're just guaranteeing them to be one more car in the congestion. But now you can take transit. I don't even want to just limit it to Skyline. You can take Skyline, yes, but you can also take a W line, an A line, or a U line and bring yourself out there, and then somebody can pick you up from there. And I just think that's a change in the formula, a level up for everybody that you don't have to impose upon your friends, your ohana, and everybody else to help rescue you from the airport.
And then drill down again on the military's Makalapa station, because we're talking a couple thousand shipyard workers potentially, and they have a parking problem on base.
Absolutely.
We've heard that time and again.
Yeah, and we hope to be a part of that solution. Not only do they have a pre-existing insufficiency of parking on base, but they're also doing the dry dock construction work, which brings another couple thousand people to work overnight. And so we just want to make sure that we're there for that solution. We can deliver people in time to make the trip in or out of Joint Base Pearl Harbor, just deliver a solution and maybe be a premium solution to people. I know depending on the security levels at the gates, there are sometimes lines that spill out, and you know, we see it kind of ramp up on social media, but with the Navy's cooperation, they've let us have some priority getting into the gates with our buses. So there's no better advertisement for us than have a stress-free commute on Skyline and get a priority pass into the base on the bus.
So the bus will be providing service for those military workers?
Absolutely. So that PH-8 route that we have now that starts at Halawa and services both Pearl Harbor and Hickam will be modified to operate from Makalapa Station and go into just the shipyard. And we'll be able to do really quick turns. We're going to have 10-minute service during the peaks when most of the workforce is moving. But we're also extending to have all-day service into Joint Base Pearl Harbor. Just because people had said, that's fine if I come in the peak. But if something happens in the middle of the day, I want to be able to leave. And just understanding how many people are invisibly behind the fence line at Joint Base Pearl Harbor, we want to be able to serve them all day.
And the base is a very large area. What about options for biki bikes? Or maybe some people will bring their scooters and not take the bus. Maybe their offices are closer.
That's what they're doing now, which I love seeing. We have such a variety of devices. You know, the things that we've talked about, whether it be e-bikes, regular bikes, electric scooters, one wheels, all of those things. So if you ride Skyline during the peak hour, you get to see those. And we found out that there, like, we were averaging a pretty high number of devices on board our Skyline trains before and after the shipyard starts and ends. And HART did some very thoughtful design on the Makalapa Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam Station. It is a station that actually has, within the station fencing, so in our paid area, we have what I like to think of as a reverse bike and ride. You can actually park your bike there, and I think we've designed it so that you could leave it overnight. So you could leave your bike in the station, and we have these double level racks and a little room for that. And the concept is that you can leave that and use that as your last mile, just cross into Makalapa and go where you're going to go. And that's a little bit of a shift in what we normally do. But we've really accommodated for bicycles at the Makalapa station.
And that's for people that own their own bikes. But what about people that may want to use a Biki bike? I don't know. And I know Biki bikes is under the DTS Kuleana right now.
Yeah.
So are there plans to include Biki bikes, or is it offered now?
Absolutely. So Biki is a component of our multimodal system here in Honolulu. And right now we're trying to stabilize the Biki deployment in town and perhaps extend it past Iwile to get into Kalihi. But definitely an expansion of Biki into other parts of the island is definitely in our view, especially as we start to fortify the links along our Pearl Harbor Historic Trail, which actually mirrors the skyline alignment. We think that's a very important area of focus. Right now, I think we would totally want to work with the transportation demand managers on the other side of the fence at Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam. And we've had a great relationship with them in the past 3 to 5 years to see if that's maybe an option that we could deploy in partnership with the Navy.
And then talk again about the Lagoon Drive stations, because that's going to provide a whole nother really like hub and spoke center, right, for riders who want to go into Waikiki and then just in that general area.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good question. A lot of people have asked us, why Lagoon Drive? Everybody's always said, why don't you just make the connections at Kalihi Transit Center? So the answer to that is Lagoon Drive is a great location if you're hopping onto what I like to call the Five Sisters. We have east-west corridors that go through Kalihi and into downtown. So we have School Street, we have King Street, we have H1 Freeway, we have Dillingham, and we have Nimitz. From Lagoon Drive, it's very easy for us to just have our buses leave the Ahua Lagoon Drive station and choose a path into either Waikiki, downtown, or Manoa. And what we know about our system is the Kalihi Transit Center is a great gateway to Kalihi. From that point, you can get to so many places between Kalihi and downtown. So basically, if you're going to downtown and east, it's Lagoon Drive is going to be your stop. From there, you can get the A line, the U line, and the W line. Again, A line also goes to UH Manoa ultimately, but it goes via Chinatown, downtown, Kaka'ako, Ala Moana, and Makali. The U line will go one stop to UH, and the W line will go through Nimitz Highway, through downtown, through Kaka'ako, but ultimately end in Waikiki. And that is a significant improvement in efficiency and ride for passengers who currently use our Route 20. Route 20 currently takes about maybe an hour and 20 minutes to get to the zoo from the airport. And we're reducing that down to about 40 minutes. And the difference is we're going from about 50 stops to about 15. And just the ride quality and the rapid nature of that route, I think, will attract so many riders. Like I said, that's kind of our little hidden gem in all of these changes. Yes, it is Skyline Segment 2, but all these bus routes will contribute to making a better connected multimodal ride for all of our passengers.
And so how are our drivers doing anticipating this change?
This is a pretty big service change, and there's a certain amount of trepidation in the air. We've also introduced a new way that operations for these lines, for these landlines, for AU and W. We want the operators to actually have a sense of priority themselves so that our other regular routes will be instructed to yield to the AU and W. We've also made stops that are exclusive to the AU and W in certain places so that, you know, a lot of times we have so many buses that operate on the same corridor. It's just the nature of our city. Mm-hmm. That we can get in our own way. Just we have to sometimes wait in line we've studied the amount of times that we have to wait in line to actually service a stop because the curb is only so long. And we want to make sure that the AU and W are not subject to those. So it's been a lot of creative choosing of the most popular stops or the best stops for transfers. And that's something that our passengers should be aware of, that okay. The stops may not be the same.
I think of AUW, Aloha United Way.
That's exactly what I thought of.
So yeah. I guess people just need to kokua. There may be some hiccups along the way as we launch this service and make these changes. But hopefully a short-term pain, if there is any, for long-term gain for people.
Yeah. And with any amount of change, change is always hard. But I think the amount of good that will come out of these, I think there will be a time when people will look back and not remember what the old service looked like.
That was Deputy Transportation Director John Uchi, who we sat down with last week in advance of the new Skyline Segment 2 opening to the public with extended hours from 4 a.m. to 10:30 p.m. As for the labor talks with the bus drivers union and a possible strike, stay tuned. Keep in mind, though, the Skyline trains are driverless.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
I'm Marco Werman. The World's Newsroom brings you the big picture stories and some other stuff.
It may surprise you to learn, but in Italy, many, many mafiosi are religious.
You don't expect to find a swimming pool in the middle of the desert.
The rule number one when planning a golf course in China is to not call it a golf course.
Join us and hear the world.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
From laptops to learning apps, schools spend billions of dollars each year on education technology. But does it improve student learning?
What does the use of these phones look like in classroom? What does wireless technology mean in school contexts? That research was conducted a decade and a half ago, and we are essentially having the exact same conversation.
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following The World.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii International Film Festival's Fall Festival, presented by Hale Kulani, launching October 16th at Consolidated Kahala Theaters. Schedule at hiff.org.
This morning, Honolulu Civil Beats lead story is about affordable housing, including along the rail route in transit-oriented development districts. Here with the story is reporter Stuart Yurton. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what can you tell us? What's the plan?
Well, the plan, you know, ultimately the plan is to make housing more available to people, make it more affordable. If, you know, anybody who's tried to find a new place to live here has run into the problem. Rents are going up. They continue to increase. If you can even find a place to live, then if you want to buy a place, again, it's very expensive. The prices have leveled off, but we're still talking about median cost for a home of, you know, $1 million and more than $500,000 for a condo. So it's very expensive, and the question is, how to reduce those costs. The governor is talking about, well, what you just heard about, transit-oriented development or building along the rail lines. That's a big piece of his plan currently. And again, he's talking about Iwile. The idea is the state puts in infrastructure. Again, it's up to more than $600 million for infrastructure of all kinds. And he says that could unlock 27,500 new affordable units in that neighborhood. It's very similar to the plan for the old Aloha Stadium. Again, put in infrastructure, redevelop the area as a mixed-use place, and again, thousands of additional homes. So this is the plan. Again, transit-oriented development is part of it. So is working with the counties, coordinating with the counties on what they want to do when possible, building on government-owned land. Again, these are all parts of the governor's housing initiative.
Yes, I mean, you know, we are in a housing crisis. We've heard this time and time again. And everyone says, oh, we need to build housing. But, you know, rail is almost halfway done. And we don't really have a lot of high rise in some of those areas where it could be affordable.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's, again, everyone talked about transit-oriented development. And when you built along the rail lines, people would want to come in and take advantage of that. It really just hasn't happened. And again, now we're talking about $600+ million of additional taxpayer money to make the transit-oriented development happen. That wasn't really what we were told.
Well, you know, I know that the governor's plans, you know, met with some setback. You know, we did have the Maui fires. And then now a lot of focus is on finding, you know, affordable homes for those people who were displaced.
That's right.
A challenge.
Yeah, that's right. So, again, the Maui fires really took a lot of focus away, at least for us in the media especially. And, again, last session, the governor's green fee that he was pushing got passed. That took a lot of focus, got a lot of headlines. And it looked like housing had sort of taken a back seat. The governor insisted it hasn't. It's still his top priority. And he talked about all the things he's working on. He says that he has 64,000 units, affordable units, in the pipeline at various stages of development. A few have come online. Again, others are working through the process of getting built. But notably, about 30,000 of those are still getting the permits and entitlements that can take so long and are such a onerous part of the process of building a home.
And we know that, you know, the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, right, has been pushing to make more units available for Hawaiians as well.
Yes, DHHL is on track. The governor cited that. And Hawaii Public Housing Authority is working. It's redoing the Mayor Wright housing. So there are things in the pipeline. Again, notably, if you recall, the governor's first emergency proclamation that he issued was on housing of all kinds. It was very radical, bold. It eliminated or suspended many land use and environmental laws, and many people said it just went too far. The governor pretty quickly backed away from that and said, okay, we're only going to focus on affordable housing now. He reinstated some of the laws that had been suspended and seems to have reached a sort of detente with the environmentalists who were so opposed before. Supreme Court weighed in and said, yes, Governor, your earlier proclamation was too much. Your latest one is okay. And the governor says he's going to keep this current emergency proclamation on affordable housing in place through his term. So, again, he says it helps speed the process and it eliminates things like the school impact fees that developers have to pay. But for people trying to get a place, anecdotally at least we hear, it's just still really hard to find a place to live here.
Yeah, no, it is. But thank you so much, Stuart, for highlighting this.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was reporter Stuart Yurton. You can look for his story and more at civilbeat.org.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Our next story is about lice, not on people, but on birds. A new study started out as a school project about the lice found on wedge-tailed shearwaters, a native seabird. McKinley Weaver was working on degrees at Hawaii Pacific University and the University of Florida and combined a study of birds and something called ectoparasites in a class assignment. Ectoparasites are lice, worms, and other creepy crawlers that live on the skin and hair of animals, in this case, Hawaiian wedge-tailed shearwaters. Weaver spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the relationship between the birds and the parasites, what we do and don't know.
We don't actually know much about how they affect the shearwaters. That we do know with other birds, we have seen these ectoparasites can have a negative effect on the birds. That it makes sense when you think that these are parasites that are either feeding on the blood of the bird, or they're feeding on the skin of the bird, or they're feeding on the feathers. All of which, if you're a bird, you kind of need. And so as they break down these feathers and stuff, it makes it harder to fly, which increases the energy requirements. And so negatively affects the birds that way. So we've seen that with other birds, but there hasn't been anyone who looked into how these parasites themselves affect the wedge-tailed shearwaters, or really most seabirds. That for seabirds, we know they have these parasites on them, but we don't fully understand how they affect the birds.
What types of questions were you setting out to answer with this research about lice and other parasites in shearwaters?
One of the biggest questions I kind of wanted to understand with this was just how these parasite communities live on these birds. There are 7 species of parasites. We know that they are associated with these birds, that we have seen them when we've done collections, that when people have taken birds historically and put them in museums and stuff, that we'll see these dead lice on the skins of the birds. And so they've been categorized that way. Or a lot of work has been done at Midway when they've gone through the nesting areas, taking care of the birds there. And so we'll see a lot of the lice coming from Midway and see it categorized there. But we didn't really understand how they formed a community, or if there were any communities or universality among them. Because wedge-tailed shearwaters, we see, have a huge range. They cover most of the Pacific Ocean. We'll see them from Hawaii to Mexico to Japan to New Zealand. And so across that entire area, you would think that surely there's got to be some diversity, some change in the amount of parasites that you're seeing on these birds, especially since a lot of the times when they're out, that they're just over the open ocean and they're not interacting with each other. So they shouldn't be sharing as adults except during the breeding time. And so what I wanted to look at is whether or not there is that community of these lice, and if it's universal across their entire range, or is there this diversity? Are we seeing more lice in some areas versus others?
And then just walk us through some of the findings. So you could then identify which parasites were actually on the birds you found, and then among them, categorize them by things like age. So be able to say older birds had more parasites than younger birds.
Yeah. So we did see that the 7 or 8 species of parasites generally agreed with what we found. There was one parasite that has been reported on the birds that we weren't able to find. And we went through hundreds of specimens, that a lot more than ever previously done. But among those parasites that we did find, there were 4 species that kind of form this core community, what we call an assemblage. So it's a lice-specific community. This core group is just these 4 species, and we see them universally among all the areas. And then there are a couple other those other 3 species we'll see popping up sometimes. But we noticed that this core group will always see it across all life stages of the birds. We'll see them on chicks, we'll see them on fledglings, we'll see them on adult birds. But those other 3 species, we only ever saw them on adult birds. And so that made us kind of start to wonder, where are these other species coming from? Because all our chicks were collected on Oahu and the main Hawaiian islands, that we all know they're coming from one or a couple just breeding areas, because they mostly nest on small islands off of the main Hawaiian islands within this area. And we don't see a ton of transfer between those areas. So we think that when we're seeing these other lice on the adults, that the adults are coming from other breeding areas, that they'll sometimes change their breeding areas. So we think they're coming from other breeding areas to find a mate. These are probably younger birds that bred in Midway or Johnston Atoll or these other areas, and that they're coming into the main Hawaiian Islands. And so they're introducing more of these lice, but because they're on these adult birds, that it's probably coming from where they're breeding in these large colonies mixed with other species of birds, which made us wonder that perhaps these lice aren't specific to these birds, that those other three lice that aren't part of that core community could be a core community for another bird and then just happen to get shared because they're all living in close burrows next to each other and running into each other a lot.
What other sorts of things are you wondering given that data and the results you got?
Oh, so many things. One of the big things that we kind of wonder is just how these lice are continuing to live and adapt on these birds. That if you think about these birds, that they're living on the land for a few months out of the year, and that's it. Most of their life is spent at the sea, flying huge distances. We've tracked young chicks leaving the nests here in Hawaii. They'll fly all the way over towards Central America before returning back. And they're gone for years at a time. And so these lice are just living on these birds. It becomes its own little ecosystem. And then these birds are dipping into the ocean, that there you have salt water, you have sunlight. And these conditions are pretty harsh for insects. We don't see insects living in the ocean. There's only a few insects that'll live on top of the ocean, but none are living under the water. And so it's really interesting that we're seeing these parasites living on these animals that spend their lives on the air and on the water. And so it brings up questions of what kind of adaptations they have that allow them to live in these harsh environments and how they're able to maintain their breeding without overtaking the birds, because they don't want their ecosystem to suddenly dive into the ocean, and then they're all lost. And so there has to be some kind of balance. And the birds, we know they'll preen, they'll land on the water and preen. And so there is some kind of counterbalance that way. But we don't know whether or not there's another effect on the lice, that if they reach a certain population level, if they cut back or anything.
Anything else that you'd want listeners in Hawaii to know about this research or these birds? Just another reason not to touch shearwaters, right? Other than the fact that they are protected and you shouldn't be doing that anyway.
Yeah, it's just so important that we are mindful of our own activities, that these birds are in this careful balance with these lice, that the lice don't want to take out the entire bird population, that if one organism dies, it just goes on to feed another. But if an entire group, entire ecosystem of organism dies, it's the end of that entire species. And so it's so important that they have this balance, and we as humans have come in and interrupted this balance for so many species here in Hawaii. That just birds alone, we've had 113 endemic species, and 81 of those are either extinct or haven't been seen in the last 40 years. Wedge-tailed shearwaters, thankfully, are not quite that far yet. But by us learning as much as we can about them now, then we can be able to hopefully prevent some of those tragedies from occurring more. As listeners, as people here in Hawaii, it's so important for us to be able to make sure our actions are pono with the lives around us. And that doesn't just mean people's lives. That means the natural lives around us, that we need to make sure our actions aren't negatively affecting the ecosystems. We want to try and turn off our lights during the breeding season for these birds so they're not having to deal with that extra stressor. We want to make sure that we're not taking our dogs into these areas where the birds are breeding, that dogs and cats have killed these native seabirds and will continue to kill them. We want to make sure that our actions align with the aloha spirit in protecting what's important to everyone.
Just last question, because this research came out of a school project that you clearly went above and beyond on, how'd you do on that project? Did you get a good grade?
Oh yeah, I got an A.
That's awesome. Congrats again. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
And that was researcher McKinley Weaver and HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have a link to the new study on our website after today's show.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
A project from the University of Hawaii Library System aims to document social movements as they occur by archiving important posts on social media. The Ka'ohe Pohaku project was recently awarded a $150,000 grant from the private Mellon Foundation to plan for the new archive. Ka'ohe Pohaku means to gather stones, and its creators chose this name to build a foundation for a hale, in this case, the archive. Alfie Garcia is an information services librarian at UH West Oahu. Kavena Komiji is the Hawaiian Initiatives librarian at UH Manoa's Hamilton Library. Garcia and Komiji spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the purpose of the archive and their hopes for its development. Garcia starts us off.
Let's start with why it's important to archive the internet. I think people might have heard the saying, the internet's forever, when in fact, it's a little more complicated than that right now.
Yeah. So that is kind of a myth or a characterization that, you know, anything you put on the internet, that it will be there forever. And there's some truth to that, certainly. Anything can be saved. But what studies have shown is that there's something called link rot, where if you're going back in time to certain sources, you'll notice that you're getting a 404 error, or maybe not even that. It's just, it doesn't connect at all. Where it's basically, some studies have shown like 1 in 5 websites after a certain period are no longer functional. And if you think about how connected we are with the internet and how necessary it is for our life, there was one study that showed, I think, looking back at Supreme Court decisions and their references that they were using, there was like a significant portion that was no longer working. And if you're using these as like portals for our governance, that's hugely problematic. The preservation of the web is really critical. And as an aspect of that, social media archiving is almost not thought of at all. While there's no definitive studies that have shown a significant number, if it's analogous to what we're already seeing, that's problematic, but it's also at the behest of these larger tech companies whose priorities are not archiving, right? It's more about the present moment. We are trying to preserve content around certain significant events in Hawaii, especially dealing with Hawaiians and people living in Hawaii, but also in all of its forms, whether it's through news websites or things on YouTube, that social media component where all of these conversations are happening, they're at risk of being lost.
And Kavena, could you chime in here about specifically the priorities of archiving Hawaiian activism and topics that focus on the islands and why that's important to preserve?
We started this project actually back in 2019, which was really the height of the Kukia'i Mauna movement. We recognized the need to preserve all the social media that was being produced at the time. That's where we were all getting our information. That's where the kaheas to action were coming out of. There was conversations going on in the comment section. That's how essentially things were being organized. And so we recognized that this was a significant moment in Hawaii history and that we should be saving and preserving these stories. We just didn't know how. And so our hope is that through projects like this, we'll be able to replicate this across Hawaii, not just for Kanaka-led movements, but by focusing and starting with Kanaka-led movements, we can sort of center the Kanaka voice when historically we've been left out of these conversations in libraries and archives. And so we're trying to flip the narrative and really have this be a community-centered archive.
Mm-hmm. And Alfie, what is just the process of archiving something like social media posts?
So we've been looking around for tools, and one company or one nonprofit that we've found to be working really well is a company called Web Recorder. And they have several different programs for capturing the web. One included, which is available to the public, you can download a plugin and you install it on your browser and you can just hit a button and it will archive the file just like Internet Archive would, only you have it locally and you can store it however you want and preserve it. And so that we're utilizing those technologies. Related to that plugin is one called Browser Tricks. It's less of a manual process. You can send specific websites that you want to archive and it will do its thing. But it's also like a cat and mouse game because the companies don't necessarily want the content to be preserved, or if they make slight adjustments to the code, then that needs to be updated in the preserving program. And so it is a challenge.
Kavena, could you give a few examples of the kinds of posts that you're archiving or that you have put into this archive since 2019?
Yeah, we've actually been working with Mauna Kea Education and Awareness to identify accounts that we should be saving for the Kukia'i Mauna movement. And so we've, instead of going by post, we're trying to approach it by preserving accounts. And so that's one approach. And then the second approach that we tried to do was go through hashtags. But in 2025, hashtags are no longer used or needed. And so that's how quickly our behaviors online change. So what we've been trying to do is focus on accounts that are dealing with aina or sovereignty issues. When the Maui wildfires happened, we tried to capture content from there. We also tried for the Red Hill situation. But again, we didn't really have a good process laid out. So we were kind of just doing this piecemeal. So we're excited that Ka'ohe Pohaku will now have a foundation for this social media archive.
Yeah, talk a little bit about just the discussions that you're able to have now because of that funding from the Mellon grant.
There's four main components. So Alfie covered one where we're software testing. Our second one is we're going to actually have consultations with activists in the community and think about and have them think about and tell us what this archive should look like. Who should have access? Where should this be stored? And even whose kuleana is it in Hawaii to archive social media? We also are going to send out an online survey very soon where we would like content creators, especially Kanaka content creators, to help us shape this archive. And lastly, we have a really amazing advisory board that is consisted of three activists from Hawaii with three web social media or digital preservationists. We just had our first meeting. It was a really cool meeting to have the two groups come together because we're trying to see this archive from multiple aspects.
Kavena, one question I have is like advice that you would have for other archiving or library projects navigating the current funding landscape.
So we actually connected with the Mellon Foundation a couple years ago when Hawaii, for the first time, hosted the International Indigenous Librarians Forum. Mellon sent a representative who connected with Kanaka librarians here in Hawaii. And essentially, she just asked us what we need. And so a couple of us came up with different proposals for projects that we've been working on and that we felt were important and weren't being institutionally supported. And so this is how Ka'ohe Pohaku receives the funding.
I know that like some of the goal of this will be shaped by hearing from stakeholders, but in an ideal world, you know, in a year when this funding is up, what do you hope to have accomplished on the archive?
All of our findings from this project will be culminate into one report that will be made publicly available. And so our hope is that we'll be able to at least have a more defined workflow and process so that when things start happening in Hawaii, we'll be able to quickly deploy these tools and that we'll know what we're doing this time. From there, we're hoping that we can also have conversations around what access would look like for this data, because there are ethical and privacy issues that we should be considering. Anybody actually archiving social media should be considering. And so we want to be respectful of that as well. And then the whole issue also of data storage and sovereignty, because these files are large. And Alfie can probably speak more to that.
Yeah, we're really talking about terabytes of data potentially that has to then fall within this kind of preservation framework, right? So if you're an archivist and you're a digital archivist, there are certain methods that we have in order to be like a trusted archive or a trusted digital archive, and usually at minimum having three copies of everything and certain copies of that content living on in permanent storage and on the continent or a geographically different location. So those are all like legacy issues that we have to contend with. And it's a big challenge. So like finding out where we want to house all of this content, is it because this is a Hawaiian-centered project, should we still have all the data here? You know, data sovereignty is a major concern, and that's part of the ethical concern. But in thinking of like what we would like Kavena said, if we could just have something that we could easily deploy depending on the situation as it will arise, right? We've done the Lahaina wildfires, and that was after the MKEA, the Mauna Kea protests and against the TMT, and these things will continue to arise. And every time one does, and we've grabbed things as best we could, we're always left with this like sinking feeling that we've lost so much. There's always some content that we can't grab. And so like having a well-defined structure, knowing what our scope is so that we don't run into like scope creep, so that we're not grabbing too much. Those are questions that we want to have resolved by the end of this project and be able to hit the ground running.
Those were librarians Alfie Garcia and Kavena Komeji talking with HPR's Maddie Bender about the Ko'ohe Pohaku project. The archive was recently awarded $150,000 by the Mellon Foundation to document Hawaiian social movements through social media. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, we hear from the State Transportation Director about his hopes for rail and servicing the thousands of employees who work at the airport. Do you think rail will help your commute? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Did you know that you can find the conversation as a podcast? Head to our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.